Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, Jay Fox will chat with an expert about services available to veterans in Central Ohio. And we'll hear more about a big investment the U.S. Department of Agriculture is making in Ohio farms. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
Central Ohio is home to almost 100,000 veterans, of which an estimated 20% may have a service-connected disability rating. Marine and Air Force veteran and disabled American veterans, Chief Communications and Outreach Officer Dan Clare joins us now on Columbus Perspective to talk about the DAV Entrepreneur Program. How are you, Dan?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Great to be here.
For those who don't know, what is Disabled American Veterans?
Sure. DAV is a charity. We're a nonprofit. We provide a lifetime of support for veterans of all generations. We help their families. We help their survivors. We help nearly 1 million veterans every year access the health care and benefits they've earned. So DAV is founded here in Ohio, Ohio-based charity. And we represent veterans' voices on Capitol Hill, and we connect them with meaningful employment. And that includes DAV Patriot Boot Camp, our entrepreneur program.
So tell me a little bit more about Patriot Boot Camp. How did it get started? What was the impetus for this program?
Yeah, the program was actually founded by the tech community, people who are civilians who just wanted to help veterans make business accessible to them. So it was founded by them. It became a DAV program a couple years ago. It empowers business founders in the veteran and military community. That includes our spouses. It empowers them to pursue their dreams of entrepreneurship. So it's a great startup education that we provide folks. There's great mentorship, access to resources. And we really have a community that is committed to the success of these veterans. And all of our services are offered at no cost to the folks who participate.
So how does one get involved in and when would be the next DAV Patriot Boot Camp event in our area?
Yeah, well, the next event is right around the corner. It's just down the road in northern Kentucky, in Erlanger, Kentucky, just south of Cincinnati. February 5 through 7, we have our next cohort. That's what we call kind of the class of boot camp folks who are going through here at DAV National Headquarters. It's going to be a three-day program. Entrepreneurs are going to get everything they need. They're going to get experience covering how to fund your business, common legal startup mistakes. We're going to talk about that, deploying marketing and sales strategies, storytelling, pitching. We cover a lot of stuff in 3 days. It's very intensive. And of course, we have great mentors from Ohio and throughout the country who provide participants with really great one-on-one guidance and kind of help them avoid making the mistakes that they maybe had made as CEOs themselves or as marketing folks themselves early in their careers. And so it kind of changes the trajectory of a veteran's veteran's venture.
So the business leaders who get involved, they don't necessarily have to have a connection to the military, correct?
Absolutely. We're looking for people who can contribute. We're looking for folks who are CEOs. We're looking for folks who have specialized skills, whether that's product development, operations, finance, marketing. You don't have to have served in the military to serve those who did. And we want to give people a chance to give back. So if you know a great mentor prospect or someone who has some great programming ideas for DAV Patriot Bootcamp, we are thrilled with your contributions.
And that's the appropriate word. It's not a paid gig. It is a voluntary contribution, correct?
Absolutely. All these, and we're actually amazed, especially in the Cincinnati area. We've had a ton of help with the program. Yeah, it's all, these are folks who just give their time, and their time is worth thousands and thousands of dollars. We have attorneys who volunteer. So we're really grateful, and we just couldn't do this without a community of support, and that's what we see here in Ohio for DAV Patriot Boot Camp.
So we know that when we use the term disabled American veteran, we're not just talking necessarily about physical disabilities, but it could be PTSD or some other form of emotional disability. And we want to make sure that regardless of what the circumstances are, those veterans feel empowered to come to something like this. So are there any stories of Ohio success or Columbus success that you might point out to somebody who might be listening today, who might be thinking, yeah, maybe I should do this?
Yeah, I mean, I think of Alan Parsons. He's a guy, and he's a Cincinnati area guy who's just done amazing things with his company. He's a Marine veteran. His company is called Go Faster. And that's what in the Marine Corps, you know, they kind of rename everything. The bathroom becomes the head and things like that. Well, in the Marine Corps, you call a flashlight a moonbeam, and you call tennis shoes, running shoes, Go Faster. So his company is called Go Faster. And he's designed a shoe that is kind of a hybrid trail shoe and a regular running shoe. And it's a great business. We have just a ton of fantastic people in the state who have just done great things through the program. And Alan's one of those people that we're just amazed with what he does.
Do you find that the alumni from the program come back and offer what they've learned to future generations of participants?
Absolutely. We see that the folks who participate in the program all want a mission. They're all looking at ways that they can serve their communities, continue kind of the service that they left behind when they exited the military. So the program, just our goal is just to make entrepreneurship accessible to the people who fought and defended our country and gave up kind of the prime years of their lives where they could have been, you know, in that starting phase for the folks who become, you know, multimillionaires. We want to give veterans that same opportunity to participate in the American dream.
Well, before I let you go, let's give listeners a website where they can go for more information.
Absolutely. If you know a veteran who needs DAV's regular assistance, you know, help with benefits, transportation, employment, send them to DAV.org, please. And if you're interested in participating as a mentor or as a participant in our entrepreneur program, please visit patriotbootcamp.org.
Dan Clare from the Disabled American Veterans, thank you so much for being with us today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
USDA Undersecretary Jenny Moffitt joins us now on Columbus Perspective to talk about our food system in Central Ohio and how across the country, $4 billion has been invested in over 60 ag department programs. Welcome to Columbus Perspective.
Thank you, Jay. It's a pleasure to be on with you.
Secretary, why did the Biden-Harris administration decide to invest so heavily in America's food system?
Well, I think core to all of it is that we believe that all people deserve access to healthy and affordable food for their families, for their communities, and that farmers deserve the opportunity to thrive and grow their businesses. We all recall at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, the food supply disruptions that we all experienced. And we realized that there was a critical need for change and a new approach for America's food system. And that is really the impetus behind it, is what we saw there. And the $4 billion that you referenced in the opening is a really important investment in America's farmers, who are the backbone of the food supply chain, as well as, of course, investments in jobs in rural regions, building partnerships between local producers and consumers, and importantly, making nutritious food and locally available food to more people across the country.
Is that what you mean when you say strong and resilient?
Strong and resilient means that there is more opportunities and more options for farmers to get their product to market, and more opportunity and more options for consumers to be able to buy that. When we have a more flexible food supply chain, when we have more diverse choices in the marketplace, whether that is diverse and expanded processing opportunities in all of the different agricultural communities, that means that there is just more opportunity for flexibility in the food system. A farmer can sell to one processor or to another processor. They have choices in the marketplace. And then the same for consumers. And what that does is it relieves some of the kinks that might happen if there is a disruption in one part of the supply chain.
You talk about transformational framework change. Specifically, what changed?
Well, I think what's really important is that we looked across the supply chain as we were making these investments. So the $4 billion is funding that Congress authorized to USDA through the American Rescue Plan. And they said, use this money to invest in a more resilient food system. And when we reached out to folks and said, how do we best invest this one-time dollars in really transformational change, they said, we need more processing capacity. We need more distribution capacity. But don't stop there. We also need to build the community capacity to support local food systems. And we need to drive that change through markets. And so that's why you talk about the 60 different programs that we have. What's really important about these programs is that we invested in a whole bunch of different supply chains, meat and poultry, dairy, farmers markets, everything, organic markets. We really invested across the spectrum, specialty crop markets, you name it, we invested in that because we knew that it needed to be a yes and approach. We needed to invest in capacity and processing and distribution, but we also needed to really create and drive demand. I think one nice example of that is the farm to school programs and the local foods for schools programs. We have 67,000 schools across the nation that have a farm-to-school program, and we invested and supplemented that with $2 billion in purchasing local foods for schools. What that's meant, for example, for Ohio means that we've invested $63 million to support local food for emergency food providers, schools, and child care centers. And not only are we buying that food and getting that great food into Ohio schools and food banks, but 200 local producers have been able to have new market opportunities that they hadn't had before by selling to local foods, selling to food banks, and getting their great food into those really important market opportunities as well.
I want to go back to the word resilient for a moment. In the past few months, we have heard dozens of news stories about food contamination and issues with regard to disease. How safe is our food system, and will this investment work to make it more resilient and protect it?
The United States has one of the safest food supply chains between the oversight, of course, of the federal government, between the FDA and USDA, depending on the food product, and, of course, also our partnership with states who are really important partners in ensuring and assuring that we have a safe food supply chain. I think those are really important aspects of all of this, making sure that we continue to do testing, that we provide oversight, that we provide and regulate the food supply chain to have that safe food is, I think, such an important part. We recently celebrated it in the United States, 100 years of pasteurized milk, for example. And that has made a world of difference for the lives and livelihoods of people around the country to be able to continue to enjoy milk and know that that milk is safe to drink because it has been pasteurized. I've been working, of course, on highly pathogenic avian influenza, for example, and that has been an important part of it, right? We can kill the virus through pasteurization. And so pasteurization has been such an important part. But a resilient food system, as you, I think, started off with, is really important as well. Because if we have a supply chain disruption with one aspect of a processor because they have a food safety recall, there are other processors in the region that can pick up the slack and fulfill orders and make sure that folks have continued access for the food that they need in the event of a recall. And so the resilience is really important. I would say also to just keep great product on the shelves for consumers at all times.
Well, we sit here in downtown Columbus talking about this subject and looking at concrete and buildings and insurance and banking. We have to remember that Ohio is an agricultural state. I want to thank Jenny Moffitt for joining us. She's the USDA Undersecretary. Where can listeners go to learn more about the Food System Transformation Network?
Yeah, thank you, Jay, for having me on. It's a pleasure to talk about the work that we're doing and what it means for Ohioans. So listeners can go to usda.gov/markets to learn more about the work that we've been doing. And again, it's just a pleasure to be back on with you.
For Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
A newcomer and an outsider. Senator-elect Bernie Moreno will officially hold his first elected office when he's sworn into the U.S. Senate in January. Ahead on Face the State, where he stands on the big issues heading into a new Trump administration.
We talked about wanting a red wave. I think what we have tonight is a red, white, and blue wave in this country.
Ohio Senator-elect Bernie Moreno rode the red wave to a nearly four-point victory over three-term incumbent Sherrod Brown.
I'm going to work my tail off for the next 6 years to make sure we have great opportunities for everybody in Ohio.
Right now, he's preparing to take office and push the Trump agenda on government spending.
I agree with Elon Musk. I think you can take $2 trillion a year out of the federal government.
On border security and immigration.
An agenda that says we are pro-immigration, but not pro-invasion.
Including ending temporary protected status for Haitian immigrants in Springfield.
So if you're running a business, what is your plan March of 26? And it can't be, well, let's keep extending temporary protective status.
And on President-elect Trump's cabinet picks, throwing his full support behind them, some controversial. Moreno heads into office with a promise to work hard for his supporters and Ohioans who did not vote for him.
Just know that I will always advocate for you. I will always have your back, and I will work for the next 6 years to win you over.
One-on-one with Senator-elect Bernie Moreno, now on Face the State.
After what he called a grueling two-year campaign, Republican Senator-elect Moreno takes over a seat held for the last 18 years by a Democrat. He won the race with 50.2% of the vote to Sherrod Brown's 46.4. His victory helped flip the Senate to a Republican majority. Senator-elect Moreno is here to talk about the big issues as he prepares to take office. Senator-elect, first of all, thank you for your time and for coming in for Face the State. Appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to start with that promise that you made to voters who didn't vote for you. How are you going to work practically to win them over?
So what we've already started. So what we've done is we've gone out and done reach out to the Hispanic community in Columbus and in Cleveland, to the Black community in both of those cities as well. Talk to non-traditional groups where Republicans just don't go in there enough. I think it's different when you go in there as a senator versus going there as a candidate, because I think the community looks at it and goes, well, you're only here because you want my vote. So now we've already been in office. We know we're going to be in office. So it's about making an outreach and seeing what their issues are. What are they concerned about? We've also reached out to all the mayors of Cuyahoga County. We'll do the same thing in Franklin and in Hamilton to see what issues, how can my office be helpful to them?
And also setting up offices in places where you had talked about Athens County.
Yes.
As being a potential for an office that you would set up.
Yeah, we want to make sure we're in every corner of the state and that we have an incredible constituent services operation. In fact, we're going to have more staff in Ohio than in Washington, D.C., which sets a priority. We want to really create a constituent services operation that rivals the best of the private sector.
Let's talk about the big news that's happening right now as President-elect Trump begins to fill his cabinet and put forth his nominees. You came out strongly in support of his nominees this past week, including Matt Gaetz, whom stepped out of the race yesterday or earlier this week and said that he was withdrawing his name from the nomination. Now Pam Bondi is in place as that nominee. First of all, Matt Gaetz, what do you think about him pulling his name out of consideration?
I think it was a heroic thing that he did. He didn't have to. I think he could have stayed in the fight, but he would have distracted, of course, like he said, what we need to do, which is we need to stay focused and united as a Republican Party. Look, the reality is every single Democrat voted to confirm President Trump's cabinet. There wasn't one Democrat that made one negative comment about any of Joe Biden's picks. And objectively, Joe Biden has had the worst cabinet in American history. So what we have to do as Republicans is understand that President Trump received a mandate, and we owe him the opportunity to govern with a team that he's going to select. So I have full faith and confidence in President Trump to select the team that he's most comfortable with, and it's incumbent upon us to get that team confirmed as soon as humanly possible.
Nominee for Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, also faces some accusations from a woman who says he sexually assaulted her. It was investigated. He didn't face any charges out of it. Does that kind of accusation give you any pause in supporting him when he does come up for confirmation?
No, not at all. We don't live in a justice system that accuses people because of allegations, especially allegations that were investigated and not found to be credible. So at the end of the day, we have to go by a justice system where, in which if there's a result that, or there is a conviction, but there is a presumption of innocence, right? So we can't be defaming people because of accusations. Look, in my own primary, there's lots of accusations launched at me that were absolutely, totally, and completely false. So we can't judge nominees that way. Pete's a great man. Went to Princeton, went to Harvard. He's a combat veteran, a hero, great communicator. He's going to do some great things in the Department of Defense.
And Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Has been a big supporter of the president-elect. He's been criticized for some of his stances on vaccines and also on unpasteurized milk. Do you have any concerns about him, or why do you support him for the office?
Yeah, you got to remember, we need reformers in these agencies. And at the end of the day, the agenda that those cabinet nominees are intended to do is President Trump's agenda. So it's, what does President Trump want them to do in HHS? So Robert Kennedy is not going there as President of the United States to run HHS. He's going there as somebody who's going to fulfill the agenda of President Trump, which is to make the government more efficient, deliver better health care to this country at a lower cost.
Let me go back to Pam Bondi, first of all, for now the new pick for attorney general. What do you think of her, the former Florida attorney general?
Yeah, I know her very well. We did a panel together, actually, in Toledo during the primary. She's great. She's ruthless on these criminals. Look, if I'm a Mexican drug cartel member and Pam Bondi's going to be the attorney general, you better watch out. If you're somebody who is conducting illegal narcotic activities in Ohio or anywhere in America, Pam Bondi's coming after you. She's a absolute phenomenal pick. I expect a full unanimous vote on her on the Republican side. And I think she's going to pick up a few Democrat votes, honestly.
Now, you have you've made border security and immigration a big issue. I know it's one of your priorities. President-elect Trump has said he wants to do a mass deportation of undocumented immigrants. How can the administration pull off something of that scale when you're talking 11 million to 13 million potential immigrants?
Well, you got to remember, we've had about 10 to 13 million people come in over the last 3.5 years. So it's obvious that we can also expel them over the same period of time. And it's a national security imperative. These people have not been vetted. We have no idea who they really are. If you go to the Border Patrol agents themselves will tell you they have had no time, no opportunity to vet them. We know that at least 500,000 or more are convicted criminals. We've flown in criminals and rapists and murderers into this country. So we start with the worst of the worst. My personal belief, and I have not discussed this with the president, but my personal belief is that we should not house foreign nationals in our jails at all. So we need to expel any foreign national that's in any of our prisons. We're not going to spend that. Or if that country refuses to take a convicted prisoner from their country, that we should charge them a huge sum of money per prisoner per year and take that money through means that we have through our banking system. So we're just not going to spend U.S. taxpayer dollars housing people that shouldn't have been here.
The American Immigration Council estimates the cost of this mass deportation for arrests, detention, processing, removal, as well as the costs for, to the economy and the tax base and jobs, would be about $300 billion. How can the administration justify spending that much money on this plan?
Well, the estimates are that taking care of illegals in this country was costing us $451 billion per year. This is free health care, free education, housing, the impact on our communities, the increase in housing costs. So I think that number could be accurate, but it's a huge savings, and it's a one-time expense. The $451 billion is every single year, and it repeats on over. The $300 billion, if that number is even accurate, I have no idea. I've not looked at that, but that seems like an enormous, a great return on investment. And most importantly, look, we have to send a signal to the world. There's one path to America, the legal path. And I'm obviously a supporter of legal immigration on our terms, but you can't have a robust legal immigration system unless you set up a community where you have a zero tolerance policy for illegal entrants or illegals to stay here at all.
A couple days after the election, you said the administration would not renew temporary protected status for Haitian immigrants in the country, but also, of course, we're focusing on Springfield, Ohio, when it expires in February of 2026. A lot of businesses, we're told, rely on the Haitian immigrants in the Springfield and Clark County area for employees. How would you, as senator, help those businesses in that transition? And do you really think that the Haitians should have that temporary protected status ended?
Well, it's temporary. by definition. So you, if you're a business and you hired somebody with temporary protective status, you had to understand that at some point in the future, that employee couldn't work for you long term. So you should make plans accordingly. There's lots of American citizens that don't have jobs. A lot of American citizens around Clark County that need jobs, that need good high-paying jobs, that are willing to go to work. We got to go put those people in the workplace. And if they need support to get those people trained up and skilled up, then let's invest in that. Let's make sure that we got Americans that can provide for their families that are here that we should be advocating for. Look, at the end of the day, I don't know how many Haitians are working in Springfield. I can't imagine it's more than a couple hundred. Because the reality is there's not that many jobs available in Clark County. Now, that's one of the things we're going to fix. We're going to reindustrialize this country to bring industry back, reward companies that bring jobs back to places like Springfield, Ohio, with lower tax rates, better regulatory environment, better workforce initiatives. I want to work with the governor, the lieutenant governor, and the state legislature to make certain that we have a robust program for workforce development. Those are the things that we'll make on our priority. But bringing Haitians into your workplace that are here for a very short period of time and then expecting that to be extended permanently is a corruption of our immigration system.
The temporary protected status system, though, is set up that they would the conditions in the country that they would be sent back to have to be able to handle them. Right now, there's gang violence, the post effects of the earthquake, government instability, extreme poverty. Do you think that in February of 2026 that it would be even possible to send those immigrants back?
Oh, absolutely. And by the way, those conditions exist in Colombia, where I'm from. Those same conditions exist in Chile or Brazil or Argentina, most of mainland Africa. So this is conditions that exist all over the world. And it's patently unfair to single out one country and say, well, we're going to give you special treatment. Our immigration system is built on fairness and the rule of law. And we have to treat every country equally, and we have to bring people here who are going to be additive to our economy. The reality is we have no idea how many Haitians are in Springfield. It could be 30,000. It could be 13,000. We have no idea. What I can tell you is whether it's 13 or 30, they don't all have jobs. They're on our social safety net systems. And those social safety programs are intended for American citizens, and they're already extremely fragile. We're $36 trillion in debt. We can't be spending $100,000, $110,000 per year to take care of an illegal immigrant that really shouldn't be here. We don't have the resources to care for the rest of the world. And there's other countries.
But these folks are here legally.
Well, they came here illegally, and they were
not
granted.
Haitian.
There's a lot. I saw them firsthand. I was in Del Rio, Texas. We had 18,000 Haitians that were underneath the International Bridge that crossed over and claimed asylum. But those are not valid asylum claims. So the administration knew that. The Biden administration knew that. So instead, they granted them temporary protective status to give them this pseudo-legal status. But the reality is that's a corruption of our immigration system. We bring 1 million people into this country legally. And we should reward the people that are patiently waiting in line, that are willing to learn English, that are willing to assimilate, that aren't here to take one dime of government benefits, that are going to be additive to our economy, and that don't lower wages. And we also have to take away the freebies. We shouldn't be providing free health care and free education and free food and free housing assistance to people who aren't even supposed to be in this country. Because, again, the taxpayer dollars should be used to benefit American citizens. That's what was litigated on November 5th. The American people were given these two choices, and they overwhelmingly supported President Trump.
We're going to take a break right here, but when we come back, we're going to have much more with Senator-elect Bernie Moreno.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
Welcome back to Face the State. Senator-elect Bernie Moreno will be Ohio's senior senator, even though he is brand new to the Senate. That's because Governor DeWine will choose the replacement for Vice President-elect J.D. Vance when Vance resigns from his Senate seat. Senator-elect Moreno is my guest for the entire program today. Senator-elect, first of all, have you talked to the governor yet about whom you would like to see fill that seat?
Well, I've given him, I think ideas of, to generally speaking, the kind of person he should select, and we're totally aligned on that. It's got to be somebody who can raise money, somebody who's not going to draw a big primary opponent, somebody who can easily win a general election 26 and 28, somebody who's willing to work hard and make certain that they make an effort. and somebody who understands how the Senate works. And actually, what's interesting is Governor DeWine has been a senator. And so he understands the Senate uniquely, different than most other governors who are making this decision. So I'm confident he'll make the right decision.
You criticized Senator Brown for voting almost 100% of the time with the Biden administration. I'm curious if there are areas where you will depart from President Trump once you're in office.
Well, my criticism of Sherrod Brown was that he voted almost 100% of the time with Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, and yet ran a campaign in which he said he fought with Biden and Harris and didn't go along with them. So it was just a total lie that he was somebody who was bipartisan or moderate. He should have run a campaign in which he defended his votes and defended his position. President Trump endorsed me in the primary. I endorsed him before he endorsed me because we're aligned ideologically. We both know that we have to create an agenda for American greatness, an agenda that reindustrializes this country, sets up a situation where we leave this country better for our kids and grandkids, shrinks the size of the federal government, has peace and stability around the world, and that we have a safe and secure border. So we're totally aligned, and those are going to be the priorities that we get done over the next 4 years while he's in the White House.
And at this point, you don't see any areas where you might split?
No, right now, look, we have an agenda. That's what's great about business people is we put together these are the things that we want to do. It's called Agenda 47. Your viewers can look that up. Mm-hmm. It's 20 bullet points, and we're going to focus everything on that.
What's the biggest challenge that you see for Ohioans right now that you're going to tackle right away?
We have to lower the price of everything. Look, living a normal life has gotten something that's out of reach for most Ohioans, whether it's affording a home, affording rent, affording a car, something I care a lot about. You know, the average price car is almost $50,000. The average car payment is well over $500 a month. That's not affordable for most people. And then used car prices continue to be high. There's only four cars that really are available that are under $25,000 brand new. That's untenable for most people. Even though paychecks may be going up a little bit more, you're making a little bit more, you're falling further and further behind. We need to make sure we have safety in our communities. We're seeing that in Columbus. People here need to feel like we live in a safe community. We have to have good schools. We have to shrink the size of the federal government. So those are the priorities that we're going to really tackle.
You've also talked a lot about the importance of being energy dominant. How would that help people here?
Well, Ohio sits on 1,000 years of natural gas. I mean, we are sitting on a gold mine in eastern Ohio. We should be an energy dominant nation, but Ohio will disproportionately benefit from that. So between natural gas, coal, we should have a moratorium on shutting down any more coal-fired plants because we need that energy. We got to be investing in nuclear, which is the ultimate form of green energy. We have oil refineries here in Ohio that we make certain that we protect. We need strong energy dominance because it's with reliable, affordable energy that allows us to bring manufacturing back at scale to the United States. So those are the things. And by the way, it's the input cost for almost everything. We've got to lower the cost of prices.
You also talked in your victory speech about cutting government spending. How bad is it, in your opinion, and what can you do about it? How will you attack that situation?
Oh, it's outrageous. I mean, the amount of money we spend on nonsense, and it's not trillion-dollar items. There's not going to be one thing that you say, hey, get rid of this, you save $1 trillion. There is a lot of low-hanging fruit. Vivek Ramaswamy and Elon Musk, if any two duo can make this happen, it's them. So the Department of Government Efficiency, they're going to get right to work. And I think we can cut $2 trillion out of our federal budget.
Do you support cutting the Department of Education?
Absolutely. I ran on that. President Trump is 100% behind that. And just to be clear, eliminating the Department of Education at the federal level, which is 4,400 bureaucrats, which suck up a lot of resources, doesn't mean defunding public education. It's the exact opposite. We'll move that money to the states where they can implement it much more efficiently.
So the programs that are paid for right now by the federal government, such as the targeted assistance for at-risk kids for reading and math, support of neglected and delinquent kids, that funding will stay there? Those programs will stay in place?
Well, I don't know about the programs because that's going to be up to the states. What I'm saying is the entire bucket pool of money will go to the states. Think about this. A dollar goes to the federal government. The Department of Education probably returns 20 cents to the states. So you're wasting enormous amounts of money in bureaucracy. Let's take the money that goes into the federal government, move it back to the states at a dollar for dollar value, and let the states decide what their priorities are. The state here in Ohio may decide something different in California or Massachusetts, and that's perfectly fine. I'm more confident in our state legislators and our governor
to implement what they need to do education-wise.
I do want to touch on it just the minute or so we have left in this particular segment. Abortion was a big issue in the election, in particular in campaign ads against you. I want to give you the chance to clarify your position on that and whether you support a federal nationwide ban on abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy.
Look, there's no votes in either direction, whether it's codifying Roe versus Wade or putting any kind of restrictions at the federal level. The votes just don't exist. So I think what voters are going to find out in a couple years when there's the midterms is that the Democrats lied to them. The Democrats said that if I got elected and President Trump won, that abortion would be immediately banned. It overturned the will of the voters. What they're going to find is that there's just no votes at the federal level. It's not what we're going to work on. We're going to work on securing our border, having energy dominance, lowering inflation, peace around the world. So this was a return to the states. But what we can do is lower the cost of adoptions, lower the cost of having children, fund pregnancy centers, have equal access for women to contraception and health care. Those are the things that we'll work on. We're going to bring the country together on this issue.
If those votes do develop over the 6 years, though, would you support that?
I just don't think that's going to happen. And again, we're better off focusing on the things that reduce abortions in the first place. You know, this is a terrible situation for a woman to be in. We have to have empathy towards that situation and make certain that we do everything we can to support that woman to make certain that they have the resources they need.
All right. We're going to take another quick break, and we'll be right back with some final thoughts from Senator-elect Bernie Moreno. Stay with us for Face the State.
Parenting is hard. Technology can make it harder. The Family Media Plan developed by the American Academy of Pediatrics helps make it easier. Go to healthychildren.org/media plan to create the media plan that's right for your family. Whether you make a full plan or just choose a few parts that matter the most to your family, healthychildren.org/media plan is an easy-to-use tool that will help your family set media priorities and create healthy digital habits in line with your family's values. You'll also get practical tips to help make the plan work. And you can come back to revise your plan as often as you need to, like at the beginning of each school year or during summer and holiday breaks. Raising kids in the age of screens is easier when you have a plan. Go to healthychildren.org/media plan and make your plan today.
Did you get a postcard or email about a Verizon Wireless class action settlement? You're not alone. Several Reddit users posted notices they received that claim they're eligible to get up to $100, and they want to know if they're legit. So, let's verify. Our sources are court documents in the Esposito v. Selco partnership lawsuit and Verizon Wireless. In November 2023, customers filed a class action lawsuit against Verizon, accusing the wireless company of tacking on an administrative fee to their bills without first disclosing the charge. The case was quickly settled, with Verizon agreeing to pay up to $100 for each eligible customer while admitting no wrongdoing. Settlement administrators say they're sending postcards or emails to people who paid an administrative fee between January 1st, 2016 and November 8th, 2023. If you think you're eligible and didn't receive an email or postcard, then you can visit VerizonAdministrativeChargeSettlement.com to contact a claims administrator. So, yes, the Verizon class action settlement notifications are real. Verizon tells Verify it will continue to charge the administration fee at the center of the lawsuit, but plans to better disclose it to customers. With your Verify, I'm Brandon Lewis.
The American Postal Service is older than the country itself. Ben Franklin was made Postmaster General a year before the Declaration of Independence was signed. But now, President-elect Donald Trump is considering privatizing the mail service, taking it out of the government's hands.
Well, there is talk about the Postal Service being taken private. You do know that. Not the worst idea I've ever heard. Really, is it?
Several of you wanted to know whether he can actually do that. So let's verify our sources. The Postal Reorganization Act, the U.S. Postal Service, and Paul Steidler, a senior fellow at the Lexington Institute. The Postal Service as we know it today was created by the Postal Reorganization Act of 1970. That law clearly states that the mail has to be delivered by the government, not private companies. Quote, "The United States Postal Service shall be operated as a basic and fundamental service provided to the people by the government of the United States, authorized by the Constitution, created by an act of Congress, and supported by the people." It also lays out the fundamental requirements of that service, such as delivering 6 days a week and delivering to every address in the country, no matter how remote and expensive it is to reach. Because it's enshrined in federal law, the president cannot change this with executive order. So we can verify, no, the president cannot privatize the Postal Service. With your Verify, I'm Casey Decker.
And welcome back. We just have a couple minutes left with Senator-elect Bernie Moreno. You have said that if reelected, you would only run or only serve for two terms. Why is that important to you to put that out there?
You need fresh blood in Washington, D.C., and two terms is 12 years. That's plenty of time to get your agenda completed. And if you're unable to get the things that you want to get done in 12 years, you need to be replaced. Fresh thinking, new blood, new ideas, that's what it means to drain the swamp, in my opinion. So, yeah, my commitment is one more election. And if the voters don't think I did a good job in the first 6 years, they should vote me out of office.
Thank you, Senator-elect, so much for your time. And that is all of our time for Face the State this week. I'll see you next week.
Again, that's Doug Petcash, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.